Nikki Strong. Yes, more new music. VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, John Russell has a report on calls for China to share more data about its COVID-19 outbreak. Mario Ritter presents this week's education report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
The World Health Organization and several countries are calling on China to share more data on its COVID-19 outbreak. At least 10 governments require travelers from China to be tested for the virus. China has criticized the policy, saying it is not science-based and has threatened measures in return. Officials are especially worried that new variants could be developing in China. Here is a look at what's going on with China's COVID-19 data. Chinese health officials publish a daily count of new cases, severe cases, and deaths. The numbers represent officially confirmed cases. China only records deaths from pneumonia or respiratory failure among COVID patients as COVID deaths. In other words, infected people who die without suffering either of those conditions are not counted as COVID deaths. China is doing COVID sampling studies, said Ray Yip, former director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control Office in China. However, Yip said, the government is not sharing its findings. The Chinese government reported last Thursday a total of 9,548 new COVID infections and 5 deaths. But some local governments are releasing much higher estimates. Zhejiang, a province on the East Coast, said Tuesday of last week that it was seeing about 1 million new cases a day. If a variant appears in an outbreak, it is found through a kind of study known as genetic sequencing. Since the pandemic started, China has shared 4,144 genetic sequences with GISAID, a global service for coronavirus data. The number represents only 0.04% of GISAID's reported number of cases, a rate more than 100 times lower than that of the United States, and almost 4 times lower than neighboring Mongolia. So far, no new variants have shown up in the sequences shared by China. The viruses fueling infections in China are much like those reported in other parts of the world since July, GISAID said. Dr. Gagandeep Kang, who studies viruses at the Christian Medical College of Vellore in India, agreed. Kang said there was not anything unusually troubling in the data so far. That has not stopped at least 10 countries, including the U.S., Canada, Japan, South Korea, India, Australia, the U.K., France, Spain, and Italy, from announcing virus testing requirements for passengers from China. The European Union had urged all its member states to take the action. Health officials have defended the testing as a safety measure to get more data about China's outbreak. This means countries can seek to identify changes in the virus without China's help. We don't need China to study that. All we have to do is to test all the people coming out of China, said Yip, the former public health official. Canada and Belgium said they will look for virus evidence in wastewater on planes arriving from China. It is like an early warning system for authorities to anticipate whether there's a surge of infections coming in, said Dr. Ku Yung Kon, a scientific director at the Duke NUS Center for Outbreak Preparedness in Singapore. Chinese officials have repeatedly said they are sharing information, pointing to the sequences given to GISAID and meetings with the WHO. But WHO officials have repeatedly asked for more, not just on genetic sequencing, but also on hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and deaths. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus expressed concern this week about the risk to life in China. Data remains essential for WHO to carry out regular, rapid, and robust risk assessments of the global situation, the UN agency chief said. I'm John Russell.
A 6-year-old student shot his teacher in a classroom in the American state of Virginia last week. Police Chief Steve Drew of Newport News, Virginia, told reporters Monday that there was no fight, no physical struggle, and no warning. What we know today is that she was providing instruction. He displayed a firearm. He pointed it, and he fired one round, Drew said. The police chief said the teacher, 25-year-old Abby Zwerner, put her hand up to defend herself. The bullet went through her hand and into her upper chest. Her injuries were first thought to be life-threatening, but her condition has since improved, and she is in stable condition at a hospital. Drew also said that the boy used a 9mm handgun in the shooting. The gun was legally purchased by his mother and was in the family's home. He said the boy brought it to school in his backpack the day of the shooting. Drew praised Zwerner for quickly moving her students out of the classroom after she was shot. He said a recorded video at the school shows she was the last person to leave her classroom. Drew said she turned around to make sure every one of those students was safe. A school employee went into the classroom and restrained the boy after hearing the gunshot. Drew said the boy became a little combative and struck the employee. Police officers then arrived and brought him to a medical center under an emergency legal action. A judge will decide what the next steps are for the boy. Police have also talked with the boy's mother. It is unclear whether she could face any charges. As questions remained about the boy and his mother, a crowd gathered Monday night in Newport News to show support for the teacher. Lauren Palladini works with Zwerner at Rich Neck Elementary School. She told the crowd that Zwerner is sweet. She's thoughtful, she's caring, and she's been one of the most amazing teachers that I've been blessed to interact with. Amanda Bartley, who teaches at another elementary school in Newport News, asked everyone to pray for Zwerner and to pray for the young man who did this. Bartley told the Associated Press that many questions remain unanswered. Among them, how did he get the gun? Why wasn't it locked up? A good gun owner knows that you lock up your weapon. You have a safety on. You keep the ammunition separate from the weapon itself. Gun owners can be charged under a Virginia law for leaving a loaded, unsecured gun that could harm or injure children under the age of 14. However, the state does not have laws giving details on how an unattended gun should be stored or requiring gun owners to lock up their weapons. Allison Anderman is the director of local policy at Gifford's Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, a nonprofit group. She said, Virginia definitely has a weaker law than many other states that have child access prevention laws. Legal experts said it is possible under Virginia law to criminally charge a 6-year-old child, but they believe it is highly unlikely that any government lawyer would even try. To be tried as an adult in Virginia, a person must be at least 14. In addition, common law in the U.S., known as the infancy defense, holds that children under 7 cannot be charged with a crime. The belief is that they are so young that they cannot form criminal intent. A judge would also have to find that a 6-year-old could understand the legal action against him and assist in his own defense, said Andrew Block. He is a professor at the University of Virginia School of Law, who was the director of Virginia's Department of Juvenile Justice from 2014 to 2019. It's virtually impossible to imagine a 6-year-old being found competent to stand trial, Block said. Julie E. McConnell, a law professor at the University of Richmond in Virginia, has worked on youth legal cases for more than 25 years. She said government lawyers can appeal in cases that affect the child's well-being and physical safety. A judge could then order services to deal with the child's behavior or parents' cooperation in treatment. The judge could also send a child to live with a relative, a child welfare agency, or a local social services agency. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Mario joins me now to talk a bit more about this week's education report. Hi, Mario.
Hi, Ashley. Nice to be here.
This story about a 6-year-old boy shooting his teacher is very sad. It's almost too difficult to hear.
That's right, Ashley. The story tells about a really terrible event, a shooting in a school. As with all current event stories, there are lots of details that we still don't know.
Our listeners are very curious and interested in the ways people use English. I was thinking they might have questions about some of the quotes they heard in this story. For example, Lauren Palladini, the victim's coworker, says, "She's been one of the most amazing teachers that I've been blessed to interact with." What does she mean by interact with?
People don't usually say they interact with people, unless they are speaking in an official way or are trying to generalize something, rather than give a lot of details about it. Usually, people say they work with or spend time with people.
Here is another quote. The gun violence expert in the story says Virginia has a weaker law than many other states that have child access prevention laws. What is a child access prevention law?
In this case, using the word access lets the speaker avoid using another word, gun. The quote itself is not really clear. But sometimes speakers use general terms, rather than specific terms, to avoid saying something that they don't want to say, or saying something that is wrong.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thanks, Mario.
Thanks, Ashley. It's great to be on your show.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1864, the Union of Northern States and the Confederacy of Southern States were still fighting. The Civil War began in 1861. Each side had its own constitution. Under the Union Constitution, Americans were supposed to elect a president every 4 years. 1864 was such a year. And even though a great civil war was being fought, citizens of the North prepared to choose a leader. Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce tell the story of the election of 1864.
Abraham Lincoln was completing his first term as president. He hoped to lead the nation for another 4 years. He wanted to win the war between the states. He wanted to rebuild the Union. Lincoln's Republican Party was divided. Moderate Republicans wanted to rebuild the Union as soon as the war ended. They believed Southern states should be welcomed back with full rights. Radical Republicans disagreed strongly. They demanded severe punishment for the Southern rebels.
For many months, President Lincoln worked to build a political majority. He formed a new group called the National Union Party. It included moderate Republicans and some Democrats. Lincoln succeeded in gaining the support of state and local political leaders. It soon became clear that Lincoln would be the party's presidential candidate in the election.
Several hundred radical Republicans held their own convention in Cleveland, Ohio. They formed a new political party called the Radical Democracy. They nominated explorer John Fremont as their candidate for the national election. Fremont had been the Republican presidential candidate 8 years earlier. Most of the radical Republicans in Congress did not take part in the convention in Cleveland. They refused to support Fremont. They felt he had no chance to win the election.
President Lincoln's new National Union Party held its convention in Baltimore, Maryland. Convention delegates quickly approved a party statement. The statement supported the Union and the war. It opposed slavery. Delegates then were ready to nominate their candidates for president and vice president. On the first ballot, they chose Lincoln to run again. And they chose Democrat Andrew Johnson of Tennessee to run as vice president.
During the campaign, Lincoln was advised to begin peace talks with the South. End the war, he was told. Bring Southern states back into the Union. Settle the question of slavery later. Lincoln, however, believed his policies were right for the nation. He would not surrender them, even if they meant his defeat in the election. Lincoln hated the war, but he would not end it until military victory ended slavery and guaranteed political union.
In August 1864, Lincoln wrote, "For some days past, it seems that this administration probably will not be reelected. Then it will be my duty to cooperate with the president-elect to save the Union. We must do this between Election Day and Inauguration Day, for he will have been elected on such ground that he cannot possibly save the Union afterwards."
The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Chicago, Illinois. Peace Democrats were in firm control. Peace Democrats demanded an immediate end to the Civil War. They did not care if the North and South remained apart permanently. The party's statement contained these words: "After 4 years of failure to restore the Union by war, justice, humanity, liberty, and the public welfare demand that immediate efforts be made to end the fighting. Let us look to a convention of states or other peaceable means to restore the Union."
The Democratic statement did not discuss slavery. It did say, however, that any state wishing to return to the Union could do so without losing any of its constitutional rights. This was believed to include the right to own slaves. Convention delegates approved the statement. Then they nominated General George McClellan as their candidate for president.
3 days after the Democratic Party convention closed, the Union won an important military victory. Union troops captured Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta was one of the last remaining industrial cities of the South. Its loss seriously hurt the Confederacy. Now the people of the North could understand their side was winning the war. Public opinion began to change. The Peace Democrats lost popular support. President Lincoln and his National Union Party gained popular support. Even some supporters of radical Republican candidate John Fremont turned to Lincoln. Fremont withdrew from the race.
When the people voted in November, their choice was between Abraham Lincoln and George McClellan. A vote for Lincoln meant a vote for continuing the Civil War until it was won, until the Union was saved. A vote for McClellan meant a vote for stopping the war, stopping short of victory. By midnight of Election Day, it was clear that Lincoln had won. He got only about 500,000 more popular votes than McClellan. But when electoral votes were counted, he got 212 to McClellan's 21.
Before Lincoln's second inaugural, He agreed to hold peace talks with representatives of the Confederacy. The talks would be held at a Union fort on the Chesapeake Bay. Lincoln was very firm in one demand. The talks, he said, must discuss peace for our one common country. There could be no talk, he said, of Confederate independence. The Confederate representative said they could not accept those terms. The peace talks ended in failure.
Lincoln returned to Washington. He prepared a message that he wished to send to Congress. It contained a program he felt could end the war within a few weeks. Lincoln proposed $400 million in economic aid to the southern states. The money could be used to pay slave owners for freeing their slaves. Half the money would be paid if the southern states gave up their struggle by April 1st. The other half would be paid if they approved by July 1st a constitutional amendment ending slavery. As part of the program, Lincoln would pardon all political crimes resulting from the Southern Rebellion. He also would return all property seized by Union forces.
Lincoln's cabinet officers rejected the program. They urged him not to send it to Congress. They said it would be seen as a sign of weakness. Lincoln was surprised by the reaction. He thought his cabinet would gladly end the war, a war that was costing the government $3 million a day and the lives of the nation's young men. But he accepted the cabinet's advice. He did not send his message to Congress.
On March 4th, 1865, Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as president for a second term. This is part of what he said. On this occasion, 4 years ago, all thoughts were directed to a coming civil war. All feared it. All tried to prevent it. Both parties opposed war. But one of them would make war rather than let the nation live. The other would accept war rather than let it die. And the war came. We hope and we pray that this terrible war may pass away quickly. But God may wish it otherwise. He may have it continue until the riches earned from 250 years of slavery are gone. It may continue until every drop of blood made by the slave owner's whip is paid for by another made by the soldier's sword. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. Let us heal the nation's wounds. Let us do all possible to get and keep a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
That night, the White House was open to the public. Thousands of people went to see the president. Poet Walt Whitman gave this description. I saw Mr. Lincoln dressed all in black. He was shaking hands, looking very sad, as if he would give anything to be somewhere else.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.